to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Coffee speaking to you from Washington, D.C., which is now in the path of a large blizzard. According to the forecast, it's going to be between 1.5 and 2 or 2.5 feet of snow. And I would hesitate to draw any conclusions, but it does point to the, I think, the inherent absurdity of attempting to extrapolate from immediate events of this weather type, right? You can't extrapolate a long-term trend out of single events. But it is, of course, embarrassing for the global warming people to be always contending with these blizzards. So here we are. We are about 10 days from the Iowa caucus. And therefore, our program today is going to be heavily oriented towards U.S. domestic policy, which some people like, others don't like. We have to do it. It's too important, obviously, to neglect. Imagine if a country of the type of the United States were to actually go under a fascist regime, fascism seizing power in Washington. That ought to make everybody in the world shudder. It ought to make everybody in the world decide to get active or get radioactive before you find a lunatic like Trump or a lunatic like Cruz in the White House making decisions, right? Erratic, stupid, opinionated, macho, neurotic, weak. This will not work. This is a threat to the future of world civilization. So therefore, we have to denounce the things that are going on. And remember, some people would say, oh, no, that's no problem. We've already been under fascism since, some of them would say, I guess, Bush the Younger. The first term of Bush the Younger was the beginning of fascism. That is just absurd. That is stupid, self-consoling. It's a great excuse to do nothing. But from a scientific point of view, there is no way that you could describe Bush's, G.W. Bush's, first or second terms for that matter, as fascist. He doesn't have a mass movement. He didn't. He did not have actual armed gangs of the type of the Bundy gang operating. He didn't have the people who kill the abortion doctors in the campaign. It's not the same thing. And there are a lot of people in Germany in the 1930s who were telling themselves, oh, Hitler, that doesn't matter. That's all right. He'll be just another Brüning, just another von Papen, just another Schleicher. And he wasn't, was he? Very different. That is one of those lessons that most people, well, many people anyway, too many people, think they have to learn in after the fact. And after the fact, it's too late. It's a leap into the dark. So the principal idea strategically is that it's better if Cruz wins the Iowa caucus. There are two very dangerous choices, two fascist candidates, but it looks like the wretched moderate wing or moderate reactionary or lesser evil reactionary wing of the Republican Party. It looks like they're so feckless they can't do anything. So it comes down now, apparently, in the polls, which can be wrong, of course, coming down to Trump and Cruz. All right. So of those, which is more dangerous? It's clear. Trump is more dangerous. Trump is way more dangerous. Therefore, we want Cruz to win in that sense. Right? It's better if Cruz wins Iowa. And the purpose of this is to advance the project here of the extinction of the reactionary and fascist Republican Party as a force in United States national life. These people must go. They need to disappear. They need to go back to their places of origin in the South, in rural America, in the Intermountain West, in these sparsely populated areas. So let's talk about this for a couple of seconds now. In terms of the relative danger of these two candidates, right? The first thing you'd have to say is that Cruz is much weaker. Ironically, though, Cruz is stronger in Iowa because he's had lots of time to build this machine, right? You've got to have a get out the vote machine. You've got to have a caucus goers machine. And Cruz seems to have that with the help of this very, very sinister British election management company called Strategic Communications Laboratories. And they boast that they can do a coup d'etat in the third world, apparently a coup d'etat in Nepal some years back. But that's the Cruz campaign. It looks like it's more formidable. Cruz knew that he couldn't rely on charisma. He had to build a get-out-the-vote machine, drive you to the place, give you a cup of cocoa, provide health care, child care for your kid while you're voting and so forth. So that seems to be an advantage for Cruz. Now, in the larger picture, though, Cruz is severely limited. Why? Because, first of all, he is odious. He is hated. We see that among the senators that have worked with him, he's hated. We have a very interesting article this week about, this is the New York Times, this is Cruz when he was at the Supreme Court as a law clerk for Justice Rehnquist, Chief Justice of the United States. Rehnquist, of course, a reactionary, the one who codified the reactionary Reagan counter-revolution against the New Deal into various court decisions, a yes man for the reactionary Republicans, somebody who, as I recall, is famous for harassing voters, especially Hispanic voters on Election Day. So it's very, very nefarious. Cruz was regarded as somebody that you hated. You had to deal with him, but that he was an odious personality. Interestingly enough, also in this article, Cruz, who claims to be a Christian and therefore professes a religion founded on charity, and the regard for human life, he was the greatest advocate of the death penalty. And he made a drawing, he made like a card showing a graveyard with all of the victims that Cruz and company had railroaded to the lethal injection or gas chamber or electric chair, whatever it was, in these various death penalty cases that he would not. He made sure these people did not get any stay of execution. So Cruz really is odious. However, at the same time, don't let the instinctive hatred of Cruz that any normal person feels, don't let that confuse the strategic judgment. This is a great chance to bring Trump down. As we know, the entire content of a Trump rally, when Trump has a rally for the people, as soon as his goons and enforcers have kicked anybody out who looks like they might be protesting, then we hear the first part of it, de rigueur, is that Trump gets up there and reads his poll results, and he's leading here, and he's leading there, and he's killing them here. What if he loses now? It's time for him to lose. We know it's a great thing to build character, right? You can't always win. Reminds me of Yankee fans. I'm pretty sure Trump would have been a Yankee fan, right? Not like us Brooklyn Dodger fans. We cared about baseball. Those guys only care about winning. But Trump defeated is a Trump deflated, and we've got to get to this point. So find ways to undercut Trump. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. As the blizzard is advancing on the nation's capital, we're here, and unless the electricity goes out, we will complete our program. Now, remember, with a blizzard of this type, right, a severe blizzard, 2 feet of snow or something like that, These are the moments that tend to reveal the inadequacies of the dilapidated and looted system of infrastructure we have, right? After all these decades of Wall Street rule, ruled by Wall Street puppets, be they Republican or Democrat, we have this terrible situation with the infrastructure, right? How it's all depleted. And it's quite possible, and this, you know, take it for what it's worth, that by the time you hear this, there'll be some serious event, right? Maybe a life-threatening or otherwise event, because of precisely the fact that when you strain the infrastructure, it's going to tend to break down. So the idea is Trump presents himself as invincible. He's got the mythos, the mystique of invincibility. Well, we don't want to have that continue. We want Trump's mystique and mythos of invincibility to be punctured, to end. And the best way is a severe defeat. And that will then throw him into a crisis. He won't know what to say. Well, obviously he'll say it doesn't matter, but it does matter. And it will be thrown into his face. The people that he's been triumphing over rhetorically for such a long time, including these press characters, they are going to have a field day saying, now, you were invincible last week, but this week you're a loser. How does it feel to be a loser, Mr. Trump? This is highly, highly desirable because, of course, all those Trump voters, read disillusioned Yankee fans, who want to win, and that's all they care about, this is going to have a big impact on them. So from a psychological point of view, Trump will come out of this traumatized. Now, Trump is obviously more formidable. First of all, he's got $12 billion, $10 billion, even if it's only $8 billion, that's still a lot of billions. And remember, under U.S. law, you can spend unlimited amounts of your own money on your presidential campaign. So that is a big asset. If he's if he gets defeated now, then he'll have to put more money into it. And if he's not the nominee, which we certainly hope, then he'll have to put in more and more of his money to try to bounce back. Now, the other thing with Trump, as a good fascist, right, if you're defeated, if you're the fascist Trump and you're defeated, then what are you going to do? You're going to blame somebody else. You're going to scapegoat somebody, right? The entire psychology of Trump is, oh, we had an economic crisis and we've got a long-lasting depression. Find some defenseless group to scapegoat, the Latinos, the Mexicans, the Muslims, and so forth, right? Don't talk about Wall Street bankers. Don't talk about finance oligarchs. Don't talk about even the Federal Reserve. Doesn't talk about it. These bigwigs, right, these oligarchs, he talks about these defenseless groups that obviously have no ability to inflict the kind of damage that he's talking about. Are wages low? You really think the low wages are because of the pressure from foreign workers? I think that's overstated. I think the pressure involved is the pressure from the Wall Street finance oligarchs pushing down on wages, obviously using the presence of terrified, super exploited foreign workers, illegal or undocumented as they may be. So Trump will have a hard time with this. Now, Cruz is very limited, as I say. This is essentially a holy roller candidacy, right? He's a Christian fundamentalist. He's got all kinds of rhetoric about this. Interestingly, as was pointed out this week, Cruz pretends to be a takfiri, right? He pretends to be a holier than thou. But when it comes to something like tithing, which you're supposed to do, 10% for the poor, he doesn't do it. He doesn't even make 1%. So Ted and Heidi of Goldman Sachs, from the Supreme Court to Goldman Sachs, they do not fulfill many of the characteristics of what they want. But that's fine. Cruz is evil. But remember, the fundamental thing to understand about this universe, as it was wisely constituted, is that evil can be made to do good. When evil clashes with evil, the good may benefit because in that clash, there's a diminution of the net amount of evil in the world, right? This is the basis of the optimism of Leibniz and quite a few others. So let Cruz do his one service to the future of human civilization by bringing down Trump in the Iowa caucus. Cruz has less money. His base is narrower, his potential base, because he's so clearly a creature of the Bible-thumping belt. Cruz is out there telling his supporters, the Tea Party is enough to win the presidential election. Well, it's not. But fine, let him believe that. Let him believe that. All we need him to do is to bring down Trump. Now, Trump, of course, has a much greater demagogic appeal. One of the things we're going to be developing here is that Trump is not an ideological candidate. In other words, he does not even try to conform to any system. It's not a school of economics, really. It's not an approach to politics. It's not the William F. Buckley conservative compendium. He used to be sort of a liberal Democrat, but he changed that. So there's a complete chaos of formal positions on the part of Trump. But nevertheless, his demagogy, right, his appeal is that of a cultural populist scapegoating defenseless groups and attempting to deflect attacks from his friends in Wall Street. Remember, Trump is a creature of Wall Street in the sense that that's who lent him the money to do what he does. And, of course, he started with a fortune left over from his father, Fred, and indeed from his grandfather, who ran those brothels and bordellos in Alaska and the Yukon of Canada. But Trump is therefore much, much more able to address new groups. In other words, Trump doesn't care about ideology. And if the ideology gets in the way, he'll flip-flop. In other words, he'll say, oh, did I say that I didn't want to cut Social Security? Well, I do. Or more likely, something going the other way. So Trump doesn't care about that. He has less baggage. Notice also, if you have... Welcome back to the World Crisis Studio. Remember, you can check talkme.net, talkme.net. A couple of books I think of mine that are very relevant to current affairs. One would be Just Too Weird, Bishop Romney and the Mormon Takeover of America with Polygamy, Theocracy, and Subversion. That's at tarpley.net. And one very interesting thing, I wish we had more time to make these parallels. If you think Trump or even Cruz or any of these Republicans, if you think those guys are populists, you ought to go back and see what a real populist looks like. And I mean an economic populist and a progressive one, I guess I can say. That would be Robert Kennedy in 1968. That was, in many ways, the last really populist, in a good sense, movement that we've had in this country. And the idea was that he could, Robert Kennedy is one of the people I quote says, this Robert Kennedy was probably the last liberal politician who was able to address the white working class and their concerns. And he did this in Indiana, for example, during the Indiana primary in 1968, with a hero of the white workers on the one side and the black mayor on the other. And there was a program, right? End the Vietnam War and begin programs to revive the cities and even to get a better situation for organized labor, right, with Walter Reuther being there. So you would have had Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Walter Reuther, and a bunch of other people like this. That would have been a serious populist movement. Now, what you have here with Trump, a creature of the banks, or Cruz, a creature of Goldman Sachs, who was mainly advocating the death penalty in the Supreme Court. This is, of course, not the same thing. So if you want to see what populism looks like, look at that sketch that I have as the political career in the end of Robert Kennedy. And notice you can get that today. That happens to be the briefing, right? That happens to be the daily briefing of the United Front Against Austerity and the Tax Wall Street Party. So those are there. You should subscribe to that, right? Go to twsb.us and you follow the instructions and you can get yourself a free sub to the daily briefing. And I write for it a lot. So if you want to know what I'm thinking of about, then go to it. So look, Cruz is getting support from the Duck Dynasty. He's got Glenn Beck. Trump, again, Trump is the wrecking ball of the revolution. Trump is the icebreaker of the revolution, if you want. In other words, he's practically destroying the ideology of the Republican Party. In other words, the Republican Party is going to be revealed as naked power and nothing but filthy lucre, big money. Now, what's going on right now, about the middle of this week, right, between Wednesday and Thursday, the Republican establishment has concluded that Cruz is suicidal for their party. Hey, yeah, that's why we want him to win. That's where it's supposed to go. So vote Cruz or caucus for Cruz and get rid of the entire Republican Party that way, right? Damage Trump in a way that nothing else can. So the establishment is now coming out massively for Trump. And again, that's why you find us, as usual, on the other side. So we have Bob Dole, 1996 Republican presidential candidate. He says he got to stop Cruz. Sorry, stop Cruz. Trent Lott of Mississippi, senator, former majority leader for the Republicans in the Senate. He says, join with Trump, get rid of this guy Cruz. Orrin Hatch of Utah, same thing. Governor Branstad, right, our old friend Governor Braindead of Iowa, also says, Iowans, make sure you don't vote for Cruz. John McCain hates Cruz more than anything. So, right now we have the Republican establishment rallying to Trump. They love Trump. There is an exception, and these are the ideologues. In other words, it's interesting. All of these people are practical politicians, right? McCain, he's got an election. Dole was. Lott was. Hatch, Branstad, still is, right? Longest serving governor. They're all saying, you gotta rally to Trump. Now, the ones who say no to that, the National Review, right, the Buckleyites, and of course you can see why. The Buckleyites represent this effort over 60, 70 years now to develop an ideology, right? They have an ideology. You've got to have free markets. You've got to have free enterprise. You've got to have deregulation. They're basically ideas that go back to the Republican Party as it fought a losing battle against Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the 1930s, right? You got to attack entitlements, according to the Buckleyites. This package, right? The one that we know, right? The shop-worn, discredited things, free enterprise, free markets, free field. So that's what the National Review would like to defend. Because, of course, without that ideology, what is there for the National Review to write about, right? They are ideologized in the sense of William F. Buckley of the CIA and a very rich character and quite nefarious. So that's the way it lines up. Now, if you have a brain, you out there in the audience, if you have a brain, you don't want to choose sides in that sense. Like we said, it's better if Cruz defeats Trump in Iowa. Fine. But that's purely tactical, right? This kind of stuff is not like getting married, right? It doesn't last. It's just temporary. It's based on expedience. You want to try to cut the greater evil down to size. And you have to remember, this process is more open-ended than the television is telling you. Remember, they're all talking about what they call a brokered convention. Well, brokered convention, that's not very good, because that's where the smoke-filled room decides. What we want is an open convention, a contested convention. And if you go to five votes, five ballots, or 10 ballots at the convention, so much the better. Notice, in most states, the delegates who are elected in the primaries are bound on the first ballot, right? You have to vote the way the primary or the caucus told you to on the first ballot. But then you can change, right? At that point, you know, there are different systems, right? The unit rule or whatever there is. But you have to have the ability to change. And that means that a surprise candidate could be brought in. Could be brought in either party, if all of the contenders prove to be inadequate. You can have the first ballot. Nobody gets the required number of votes. Fine. And then negotiations go on. And, you know, different blocks will still be clashing and so forth. But don't think that you're limited to just the number of candidates that you presently see. Because they can, a dark horse candidate can be brought in at the very end. Now, Trump, of course, has run on the fact that he's anti-establishment. I'm going to be interested to see what is Trump going to do now that he is the establishment, that all of these bigwigs and the senior people in the Republican Party in Washington are basically coming on board because they hate Cruz so much. And we'll see. Just to get ahead of ourselves, the Bundy gang has been stripped of radical cover out in Oregon, and they're having a hell of a time. They're being reviled. Everybody hates them. That's what happens when you get your radical anti-establishment cover stripped away. Trump, watch out. Your anti-establishment cover can be stripped away, too. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the World of Washington, D.C. So what we're saying is something like this, right? In World War II, you had Europe and then you had the Pacific. You had to make a decision. The decision was Germany first, Japan later. Today, we would say Trump first. We'll take care of Cruz later on, or indeed the process itself may do that. But in order to have a healthy process, it's going to be much better if Trump comes out of there as a loser and if people can throw that into his mug. Now, let's go a little bit back into the ideas. One interesting thing that came up this week is the origins of some of these tactics, and some have traced them back to a character called Sam Francis. And Sam Francis was fairly well known in Washington. He was part of the Washington Times, not the Washington Post, but the Washington Times. And that was known as the Mooney paper, right? Because that was the Unification Church of Sun Ying Moon. And that had been this guy, Tong Sun Park or Park, who was always manipulating the Congress and so forth. So The basic idea of Francis, and you can see this, this is Sam Francis, of course. This comes from an interesting article in The Week magazine, how an obscure advisor to Pat Buchanan predicted, or was a precursor to, I would say, the Wild Trump campaign. And he did this back in 1996. So this is essentially a long shot candidacy. Remember Pat Buchanan, reactionary columnist, said to have monitored Martin Luther King for J. Edgar Hoover and that organization that he led. So the idea is here from Francis is that white America is under heavy attack, and therefore the way to deal with that is to go overtly racist, right? Complete racism, complete white supremacy, complete Ku Klux Klan, and all the rest of it, while at the same time throwing over this ideology, right, this baggage of the Mount Pelerin Society and the Chicago School of Economics, the Austrian School. In other words, forget about supply side. Forget about Milton Friedman and the monetarists, and some of them are libertarians. And forget about von Hayek, von Mises, and the Austrian school. Just dump it. It gets you nowhere. One of the premises of Sam Francis was that there are no social groups left in society whose interests are expressed by the sort of neo-Buckleyite Austrian mixture right, that it has emerged. Of course, there are such interests. They're called the Wall Street zombie bankers and even the hedge fund hyenas. So the idea is forget about all this ideology and just rave and rage about the plight of white America and how it's not fair, attack foreigners, scapegoat them, essentially go with an ideology which is indistinguishable from the Ku Klux Klan. Isn't it interesting? And then they bring in one proto-fascist source, Oswald Spengler, we know him. Pessimist, notice, the decline of the West, der Untergang des Abendlandes, right, by Oswald Spengler in the 1920s, is the document of proto-Nazi pessimism and despair, and that's what you're getting from Trump. It's a mess. Our military is a mess. The country's a mess. The American dream is dead. That is a pessimism, as I've been trying to point out, worthy of Oswald Spengler. Spengler, of course, said that Prussianism and socialism are more or less the same, so that you can be a Prussian nobleman and you can be a socialist. Well, then you become, his followers did, at least national socialists. They also want to follow Gramsci, right? Antonio Gramsci, of the Italian Communist Party. And I believe what's interesting there is this hegemonia. In other words, what you want to do is to try to dominate the culture, and then within that you can get somewhere. But conservatism is meaningless, right? Don't talk about the Constitution. Don't talk about conservatism. Don't talk about the free market, free trade. Forget all that. Deregulation. It's no good on the stump. Once you get power, you can do what you want. But this, the rationale for running for office, it just makes no sense. Now, what you're seeing here is the wedge issues gone wild. In other words, the divide and conquer that Wall Street has always practiced on working people. And remember here, we're talking about the difference between the class in itself, right? The really shameful kinds of behavior that we get from all of the existing selfish groups in society, right? The parochialism that comes to the fore. Well, that's the class in itself, right? It means that if you're in the class in itself, you don't know your situation, right? You got false consciousness. You're ideologized, right? You've been told that somebody is your enemy when your real enemy is over there in Wall Street. And then you got to contrast that to the class for itself. The class for itself means working people organized with an analysis, with an organization, with some leadership, but organized to actually advance their own interests. And that means not through the Republican Party, nor through the Democratic Party, but really through something more like the Tax Wall Street Party, because that Tax Wall Street, that expresses a primordial interest of everybody in the United States except for the one half or one quarter of 1% at the top. So there's also this idea of the elites, right? Again and again, an attempt to attack the elites. Now notice, the way they attack the elites is not based on the economic policy of the elites, quite frequently. Especially it's not based on an attack on Wall Street, right? For some strange reason. But this now brings us to the other question. There are two kinds of populism, right? We talked about Robert Kennedy. There's economic populism. Economic populism asserts that, there's gonna be a fight over, the distribution of the pie. In other words, whatever the distribution of the pie is, that is subject to political review and to political change. And the Republicans say, oh, that's redistributionism. Well, it is. But of course, it's trying to roll back the redistributionism that started under Reagan and kept going with the Republicans and indeed the Democrats, which says we're going to massively redistribute the wealth from the middle class to the very top. And we're going to shift the costs of running the society and the government and the military, and the costs of the Depression are going to go on the backs of the white people. So working people. So economic populism is bankrupt. I'm sorry. Cultural populism is bankrupt. Economic populism is the way to get out of this, right? In other words, actual rational measures. That's why you can go to Bernie Sanders and say, Bernie, where's the beef? What are you going to do? You're going to break up the banks. How is that supposed to work? You want to have a tax on Wall Street turnover? What kind? How much? What's going to be taxed? It's all vague. Bernie, where's the beef? Now, the cultural populism is exactly what Buchanan or this guy Sam Francis were dealing in. Cultural populism. And it essentially says you have this European-American component, as they call it, and those have got to defend themselves against other ethnic groups. It is absolutely absurd. It is a sure loser at the long run for the United States, not for some country. And we'll be back in just a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome to the second hour of World Crisis Radio. We're recording on Friday, the 22nd of January, 2016, and the snow is falling. It's a blizzard. It's a northeaster. 1.5 to 2.5 feet of snow, but we are undeterred. We must never flinch. So ponder this question now. Economic populism, which would allow the pursuit of a rational self-interest, the identification of an economic interest, the identification of adversary groups who want to do it some other way, developing arguments. In other words, an election based on program against cultural populism. When Cruz says, you have New York values, that's cultural populism. In other words, it's people like us, right? Plain folks like us, homeboys or whatever we are, we don't like your highfalutin ways to do it. And above all, if you're an elitist, that's really bad. Now, naturally, the people who make these arguments, right? I heard one Republican some years ago, the whole speech on Indiana values or, again, New York values. Indiana values good, but New York values, of course, bad. From the point of view of these reactionaries, let's hear. I think we can find a couple of remarks about this from Lee Atwater. Now you have to remember that Lee Atwater of the Republicans, right? He was one of the people who helped push Bush the Elder into power. He was running in the elections in South Carolina. And, of course, after Strom Thurmond had gone from being a Democrat to Dixiecrat and then Democrat, but then finally as a Republican, it was hard sometimes to get old Strom Thurmond reelected. So they had recourse to wedge issues and personal character assassination, and then, of course, the wedge issues. Now, the distinction is between the cultural or social issues populism on the one hand and economic populism on the other. This is written up in Surviving the Cataclysm. If you don't have a copy, you ought to get it. Cultural populism is demagogic. Economic populism can be can be measured, right? In other words, you're going to give me a 5% pay increase or a 10% pay increase. So Lee Atwater is credited or debited historically with developing and, perfecting to some extent this idea of the wage issues when he was working for Strom Thurmond. These are known as the hot button social issues. Well, that's Trump. He is the hot button social issue. In other words, immigration, that's the one. Or terrorism, but as a social issue, that the people are going to come among you. And, of course, anti-elitism. Anti-elitism, that there are limousine liberals. You remember George Wallace back in 1968 used to say, pointy-headed liberals. There's not a dime's worth of difference between those pointy-headed liberals and those pointy-headed conservatives or Republicans in Washington, D.C. There's a lot of this in recent American politics, right? The silent majority, Nixon, 1972, the hard hats. Notice that Trump is now using the Nixon vocabulary, the silent majority. Spiro Agnew in the 1970 congressional campaign talked about effete snobs, nattering nabobs of negativism. These were, of course, written speeches by Pat Buchanan and William Safire. And the big thing was Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, abortion, school prayer, gun control, anti-government, pro-business, anti-public unions, and hostility towards minorities, right? Be they gay, lesbian, whatever. Today, there's another dimension of this, right? The attack on political correctness. Obviously, political correctness is something I oppose. I've written against it. It's, you know, I've shown you the roots of this in Derrida and Foucault and people like this, these crazy French existentialist philodoxers, I guess we can call them. But remember one thing. Fascism is way worse than political correctness. So when you get Trump and Cruz and these other Republicans chattering about political correctness, just remember that what they represent is worse. They're trying to do a cultural populist attack on political correctness so that they can flay you alive with their tax plans and their entitlement plans in these economic schemes. Now, the most basic wedge issue is going to be white and black, at least for quite a while to come. And that gets the oligarchs off the hook. Secondarily, though, and coming up fast, is the, I suppose, white against Latino, if you want to put it that way. These are cultural populist wedge issues. They are used to attack and break up the Franklin D. Roosevelt coalition, which, you know, was, up until 1968, capable of governing the country. Now, here's the quote from Lee Atwater, the late. He says, populists have always been liberal on economics. So long as the crucial issues were generally confined to economics, as during the New Deal, the liberal candidate would expect to get most of the populist vote. But, says Lee Atwater, malignant as he was, populists are conservatives on most social issues. When social and cultural issues died down, the populists were left with no compelling reason to vote Republican. And indeed, they have plenty of reasons not to, because these poor cultural populists, a lot of them are going to get skinned alive. So what you can see, that what we seem to have is the Republican Party, where there's a widespread awareness growing that they have been duped and sold out and betrayed. But then the attempt by Trump is to double down, right, on essentially racism, xenophobia. In other words, he'd say, well, if the Republican Party hasn't been racist enough and xenophobic enough, then I, Trump, will do it by essentially driving all of these cultural populist tactics to the most most extreme form. Now, I think that's that's very much to the point. Now, let's say something also about this Sam Francis and his essay, right? The essay that is talked about in The Week, 1996. So Sam Francis says that he told Pat Buchanan, when Pat Buchanan ran for president the second time in 1996, he said, "Buchanan, you would be better off without all the hangers-on, the direct mail artists, the fundraising whiz kids, the marketing and public relations czars, and the rest of the crew that today constitutes the backbone of all that remains of the famous conservative movement," in quotes, "and who never fail to show up on the campaign doorstep to guzzle somebody else's liquor and pocket other people's money. Those people are defunct," said Francis to Buchanan in 1996. "You don't need them. You're better off without them. Go to New Hampshire and call yourself a patriot." And this has already been mortgaged in the meantime by the survivalists and the crazies. Like a nationalist and America firster, but don't even use the word conservative. It doesn't mean anything anymore. We'll tell you in a minute what America firster might mean. And believe me, it's not pretty. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Mr. Darby here in snow-covered Washington, D.C., in the shadow of the oncoming blizzard. So again, in the recent broadcast, we've been pointing, I think, clearly, I hope clearly, to the tremendous background of Trumpism in the European fascism of the 1920s and 1930s. And I want to assert that again. It's fascism. The way that this fascism comes on the scene is you take the doctrines of Lee Atwater and Sam Francis and you radicalize them several orders of magnitude. And then, lo and behold, you get something that looks very much like Mussolini, Hitler, the fascist, the National Fascist Party, PNF, in Italy, and the NSDAP, National Socialist German Workers Party in Germany. This is the intellectual or the cultural, I guess we better say, home for Trump, certainly. We also, before we get back to Trump, remember now, Cruz is a slightly different kind of fascism, and this is, I guess you can call this clerical fascism, right? Whenever you have a movement with fascist overtones in which religious leaders are playing such a big role, then you may have some clerical fascism on your hands. Clerical fascism is associated with Austria, right? And it's not the same as Hitler fascism, right? Because fascist gangs are heteronomic. They fight among themselves. Fascist gangs fight among themselves. They have rivalries. They have, all the absurd stuff that you see in Charlie Chaplin's Great Dictator, where Hitler is trying to impress Mussolini when he comes into the room. But if you have a religious hierarchy, ministers and so forth, espousing fascist policies in the framework of an attempted mass movement, then that's clerical fascism. Austria, again, clashed with Hitler. Hitler had to get them out of the way. That would be Dollfuss, the political side of it, and Monsignor Seipel, S-E-I-P-E-L, was the guy in the Roman Catholic hierarchy. But you've also got Francisco Franco of Spain, right? El Caudillo. He was very definitely, right, based on clerical fascism through a faction of the Catholic Church in Spain. Marshal Pétain of Vichy, the Vichy fascist regime in France, is clerical fascism to a very large extent. Salazar in Portugal, one of the longest lasting of these fascist regimes from about, 1925 to 1974. Codriano, the Iron Guard in Romania, and Monsignor Tisha in Slovakia. It's written T-I-S-O, but I think it comes out more like Tisha in Slovakia. He was actually executed at the end of the war as the fascist dictator of the Nazi protectorate of Slovakia. So that's Cruz. The contending force against him would be somebody like Santorum, I think, represents that. And you might mention Huckabee, but I think Santorum probably closer to the point. Now, again, with that kind of stuff, that's not made for the U.S. market, right? That's not going to fly well. So you'd have to say Cruz's ability to save the Republicans in the Electoral College, if he ever got that far, I think is practically non-existent. Because this would be, once again, Barry Goldwater vintage 1964, extreme reactionary, right? Unyielding. And remember, Cruz has got some positions in there that are still more or less old-fashioned conservatism, right, in quotes. Remember, of course, as we've been arguing here, they're not conservatives at all. They're just reactionaries, right-wing extremists, proto-fascists, whatever you want. But that, I think, means that the ability of Cruz to triumph in the general election is much less. But now, by this mad escalation of the wedge issues gone wild, I think that's where Trump could become very, very dangerous. Now, a couple of things about this. I assert, again, based on all this stuff, right? In other words, when we've got McCain, Dole, Lott, Hatch, Branstad on one side saying, we hate Cruz, and the National Review on the other side saying, we hate Trump, that's a Republican Party that is splitting itself apart. Now, therefore, Bernie, you got to talk to me, Bernie. What's your program to capitalize on the obvious split in the Republican Party to send them whirling off in at least two pieces or maybe three pieces, right? You can say, I like the Republican Party so much, I want there to be two of them or three or two, three, many Republican parties. That's the spirit we need to get into this, right? Now, of course, a craven little toady like Bernie, he doesn't think big like that. He doesn't think of a battle of annihilation, right? We're talking about a political canai. We're talking about a Schlieffen plan against the existence of the Republican Party, right? How to knock them out. They're tearing themselves to shreds. We just ought to mention the order of some of these quotes is sometimes interesting. Here, let's go back to Sam Francis, and then we can take it further. So he's talking to Buchanan in 1996. He says, Buchanan, listen to me, but I'm not sure he took my advice. He didn't. Buchanan made his bed with the Republicans then and now. Right? You can still see him on the McLaughlin group from time to time, I think. He opens himself to charges that he's not really a loyal Republican or a true conservative, and that obviously constrains his demagogy, right? Sam Francis wanted was the radicalism and the message of the middle American revolution. Again, this means white supremacists. It's obscene. It's horrendous. But he said, Buchanan, you've got to repeat that message loudly and clearly without distractions from Conservatism, Inc., the stupid party, the Republicans, their managerial elite, and sooner or later, more soon, middle America will speak with an authentic and united voice and conserve the nation. Now, you can see, these are the roots of Trumpism. You have to investigate how it got there. We'll be back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. We are talking about the bankrupt cultural populism, the ethno-cultural or race-based, xenophobic, and therefore despicable populism purveyed by Trump. And we're comparing that to actual economic populism. And again, take a look at the take a look at Tarpley.net. Take a look at our daily briefing, and you'll see that I put up Robert Kennedy, 1968, as an example of what a real populist would do. There's also the side of coalition building, right? Robert Kennedy addressing Walter Reuther of the United Auto Workers, therefore the vanguard of organized labor at that time. Robert Kennedy certainly converging, dealing with Martin Luther King. So the idea would be the various groups, labor plus the Martin Luther King groups, and those are the labor from the other side, right, the Memphis garbage men, and the civil rights movement, and the anti-war movement. And on the side of Robert F. Kennedy, you've got the anti-war movement, parts of the middle class, youth, and so forth, plus his own appeal in the black community, and Walter Reuther. Then, of course, once Eugene McCarthy had dropped out, in other words, McCarthy is the petty bourgeoisie. They don't like the Vietnam War, fine, but on the other issues, Eugene McCarthy was substantially to the right of Lyndon B. Johnson. He was worse than LBJ on most issues, precisely because he was the theoretician of a weak presidency and, in effect, rolling back the New Deal. That was the very superstitious group around Eugene McCarthy, known as the astrologers, and including somebody like Robert Lowell. Come on, Lowell, oligarch, Boston Brahmin, right? Not the the masses. So that was the big difference. The difference between Eugene McCarthy and Robert Kennedy was a class difference, that Robert Kennedy had an actual policy of uniting working people and their allies, the political working class and its allies, more or less, against the war and against the forces behind the Vietnam War. Whereas Eugene McCarthy, it was just, you know, let's get this war out of the way and go back to our, privileged existence. And again, Robert Kennedy, last white liberal politician who could talk to white workers in the Democratic Party. So let's just go back. We want to go back to this Sam Francis. Now, the commentary from this the week, Trump embodies this, the Sam Francis policy, in nearly every letter. He does not have people from the traditional Republican power structure who are advising him. This we really do not know. In other words, the question of who is advising Trump, I would regard as an open question. He obviously has a staff. We'll know more about what this looks like when we see the result of the Iowa caucus. In other words, does he have a ground operation or not? And is he getting, elaborate printouts from people? You notice Trump pulls out, 8.5 by 11 business size paper. He's got it folded three times, got that in his breast pocket on his suit. He pulls that out and reads from that, or he uses that as he plays off of it. So he doesn't need a teleprompter because he's got this stuff written down. And I wonder who's giving him the insights. Okay. So Trump says he does not say that he will direct the existing members of the managerial class, like the U.S. Trade Representative or the Department of Commerce, to make a little tweak here and there. He says he'll send his friend Carl Icahn and threaten China with a tariff wall that could repel a tsunami of cheap goods. What so frightens the conservative movement, again, there's no movement, right, but this mass of interests, what so frightens the conservative movement about Trump's success is that he reveals just how thin the support for their ideas really is. Again, forget about Austrianism, forget about libertarianism, forget about supply side, forget about monetarism and Friedman and all that stuff. It's all junk. Just get out there and do your racist routine, your xenophobic routine, and your economic chauvinist routine, right? Beggar my neighbor, in effect, right? So, The Trump campaign is a rebuke to the entire Republican intelligentsia. It says that the Republican Party does not need all those think tanks, all this supposed policy expertise. It says to Joe Sixpack, look at these people calling themselves libertarians and conservatives, the ones in tasseled loafers and bow ties. Have they made you more free? Have their endless policy papers and studies and books conserved anything for you? Those people are worthless. They are defunct. You don't need them. You're better off without them. And that would be the Heritage Foundation from the days of Reagan. It would mean the American Enterprise Institute, warmongers, neocons, and it would mean the Cato Institute, right, founded significantly or at the early phase with Koch money and still going on with libertarianism, right, even though libertarianism is just as dead in electorally, as far as we can see from the polls, as any of these other doctrines. All right. So that looks like pretty much, I guess we can call that a summary of what's going on. It's a turn to ethno-nationalistic populism, which is cultural populism. And again, the most extreme form of cultural populism is Nazism. Because it's based on race and being like us and blood and soil realism, as it was called, right? Or in the Nazi vocabulary, it was called Völkischer Realismus. Völkischer. It's based on the ethnic element, right? The race. There's an interesting book by a German sociologist called Gumplowitz where he says, Rassenkampf oder Klassenkampf. This is the same idea. Rassenkampf, race struggle, that's cultural populism. Klassenkampf, which I would recommend, is class struggle based on economic interests. And it's based on the class for itself. Not in that book, but in the way I look at it. Okay? So, another word the Nazis had. Blut und Boden. Blut und Boden. Blood and soil. Blood and soil realism, right? As Hitler and some others, Nazis, I have a compendium of this, said, think with your blood, right? Don't rationalize. Don't use your brain. Don't use reason, but think with your blood. Well, sorry, that is a loser, and it's also going to get you very, very bad results. So one of the things that Sam Francis wanted was an immediate moratorium on all immigration that would stop all immigration. Now, a reactionary raving guy like Sam Francis, he had to get some radical cover. So he was against the neocons. He was against the Iraq War. He got praise from Paul Craig Roberts. Isn't that interesting? He attacked the elites. He attacked foreigners. And you notice, again, the ideas that are supposedly conservatism, again, really reactionary, but those are the ideas of U.S. Chamber of Commerce or the National Association of Manufacturers against Roosevelt in the 1930s. And they're very old and very stale. And we'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. So we're profiling cultural populism, Trumpism, showing the basis in the reactionary ideas that have developed here over the past several decades, but then coming out now in the form of something that is overtly fascist. And there's that gang out there. Let's talk about them, right? The Bundy gang in Burns, Oregon. And we're told right now that Bundy gang, Ammon Bundy, Ammon Ra, I suppose, to his friends, of some kind of a Freemasonic name that he's got. Of course, Mormonism, he's a Mormon, but that's heavily Freemasonic. We know that. So he's negotiating with the FBI. Now, what we can say is the FBI is squishy soft on crime. And as Governor Kane of New Jersey said, they failed and failed and failed and failed and failed. The governor of Oregon now, Kate Brown, is saying that the federal government tried to gag her. I would guess, if not the White House, then Department of Justice. All right? And this, the new lady there, obviously not an improvement, because this is what she should now be executing the laws, okay? But no, not for the Bundys, right? It's one interesting Twitter lately is, it's great to know that if you're white, you can go and occupy a federal building. Maybe the Pentagon is where some of these guys want to go and occupy. So you can get it. Kate Brown, governor of Oregon, is demanding that the federal government go in there and arrest these hoodlums, these fascist land grabbers. We'd like to hear the names of the officials. That would be my appeal to Kate Brown. Tell us who in the federal government, who in the Department of Justice or White House or whatever it is telling you you should not even talk about this appalling, monstrous, ongoing incident. The editorial of the Oregonian is, it's time to pull the plug. There was a large community meeting earlier this week in which Amon-Ra Bundy showed up, and they told him, get out, go home, disappear, scram, beat it. And he was supposed to begin talking about that last Friday, a week ago today, but he didn't do that. But now they're telling him, we want to hear your plans to leave. Now, Bundy, demagogue on the defensive, says, oh, well, we want to get a sawmill built, or we want to, we've had 1,000 interviews with different people around here, and they really like us, but they're afraid to show in public. It's all, this is all ridiculous. So, this is an impeachable offense, by the way. If you want to look at, Obama, you can say, look here, it says, Constitution, the president shall take care that the laws be faithfully enforced. Well, here we have an armed rebellion, armed sedition, and that's impossible. We're also told now that one of the occupiers at the Malheur, it's not Malheur, but Malheur Bird Sanctuary, has a murder conviction. He's sporting a murder conviction. How about that? That gives you some flavor. When Bundy is told he has to talk to the FBI, he says, why is the FBI here? And then he says, you lack authority from the people. You don't have any people's authority to be here. So my question to Bundy is, who died and left you with the people's authority? You don't have any. So that's what's going on there. Now, that gang and that movement that have been energized, whichever is the winner, right? Be it Trump, be it Cruz, that is where these people will gravitate, because that's who's going to want their support. Cruz is perhaps a little bit more ready to do it right now. But when you watch, remember, the Bundys are Mormons, so watch these politicians, right? The fact that Hatch came out against Cruz and in favor of Trump, that would perhaps indicate that the Mormon establishment is going anti Cruz and pro Trump, but that there may be factions. And remember, Rubio was up a Mormon, so maybe they're also holding something for him. So you got to look back to the 1850s, right? You remember that as the Whig Party was collapsing, this ethno-cultural stuff had a lot to do with the collapse of the Whig Party when they nominated General Field Scott in 1852, he'd say, I love to hear that Irish brogue. They wanted to get the votes of the new Irish immigrants. A lot of people freaked out over that, sort of like what we're seeing today with the white ethnics freaking out because they think that their manna has been given to black or Hispanic or some other group. But that even though the Whig Party collapsed and the Know-Nothings peaked around the middle of the 1850s, by the time you get to 1856, you've got the Republican Party with Fremont making a decent showing. And then, of course, in 1860, Lincoln winning the entire thing. Now, the other thing is, you are one of these white ethnic workers, Surely your choices have been bad, right? Your living standard is down. Your life expectancy is going down. So what do you do? Well, the Tax Wall Street Party actually has a serious program to deal with this stuff, right? And you know what it is. We've got to restore the budgets at all levels with the 1% Wall Street sales tax. That will also level the playing field between manufacturing and parasitical speculation, speculation being defined as sociopathic in the dimensions that we've got. Seize the Federal Reserve. Force them to put out credit. $5 trillion of 0% 100-year federal credit to rebuild the entire infrastructure park of the United States. Another $1.5 trillion to freeze all the interest by refinancing the student loan burden. As a prelude, I hope to get it out of there completely. Then you've got to ask yourself, in terms of working class conditions in particular, you got to have a 15% protective tariff to prevent dumping and buyer of last resort. You got to have a $15 minimum wage that moves everybody's pay scales up. You've got to allow unions to revive. You've got to get rid of the Taft-Hartley Act and the right to work statute, the union busting statute, and you've got to go back to the Wagner Act, which says you have a right to a union and a right to collective bargaining. You've got to have that $5 trillion from the Fed, the federal credit, rebuilding infrastructure, creating 30 million new productive jobs. If you're in an inner city situation, or rural poverty, we're going to need 10 million jobs. These are likely to be on budget. This is going to be the Wall Street sales tax at work that will create the way for you to get into the labor force with one of these 10 million new summer jobs, entry-level jobs, youth jobs, and so forth, a kind of a, as I call it, the Marion Barry Job Corps, because Marion Barry here in Washington, D.C. was famous for giving people their first chance to get into the labor force. So you can look at that as the leading edge of a Marshall Plan for the cities, a Marshall Plan for the black community in particular, right? So black lives matter, yes, but black jobs matter, black prosperity, black living standards, all of those matter. So if you're not giving concrete solutions for those, it doesn't matter how many cops you indict. Some you're going to indict for sure. But that won't solve the problem that actually generates a lot of the tensions that we see. So if you look at the daily briefing this week, you're going to see that we have laid that out once again. For example, if there are $2 trillion of cash that's been hoarded overseas by U.S. corporations, don't give them a reward to bring that back. You see, if you don't bring that back within 1 year, you're going to get taxed to the tune of 50% of that. And maybe that will clear up your ideas in terms of your economic home. And by the way, no tax inversion. No. Trump is a snake. Trump is a snake. Not.